and each piece with care. And she wonders, if Rilke could see that, would Rilke understand? She thinks, no, of course not. Of course she wouldn't. No one understands anyone else. Turtle is wearing old Levi's over black icebreaker wool tights. Her t-shirt clinging to her stomach with damp, a flannel, an olive drab army coat much too big for her, and a mesh back cap. She thinks, I would give anything in the world to be you. I would give anything. But it is not true, and Turtle knows that it is not true. Rilke says, I really like your coat. Turtle looks away. Rilke says quickly, no, like, I really do. I have nothing like that, you know? Like, cool and old. Thanks, Turtle says, pulling the coat up around her shoulders, drawing her hands back into its sleeves. It's this whole, like, army surplus Kurt Cobain chic you have. Turtle says, thanks. Rilke says, so Anna is, like, killing you on those vocab tests. Fucking Anna, fucking whore, Turtle says. The coat sits huge about her shoulders. Her hands, white-knuckled, wet with rain, are clenched between her thighs. Rilke barks out a startled laugh, looking forward down the aisle and then in the other direction, to the back of the bus. Her neck very long, her hair falling about her in straight, black, glossy strands. Turtle does not know how it is so glossy, so straight, how it has that sheen. And then Rilke looks back to Turtle, eyes alight, putting a hand over her mouth. Oh my God, Rilke says. Oh my God. Turtle watches her. Oh my God. Rilke says again, leaning in conspiratorially. Don't say that. Why? Turtle says. Anna's really very nice, you know, Rilke says, still leaning in. She's a cunt, Turtle says. Rilke says, so you wanna hang out sometime? No, Turtle says. Well, Rilke says after a pause. Good talk, and returns to her book. Turtle looks away from Rilke, at the seat ahead of her, and then out at the window, sheeted with water. A pair of girls tamp a bowl into a blown glass pipe. The bus shudders and jars. I would just as soon, Turtle thinks, slit you from your asshole to your little slut throat as be your friend. She has a Kershaw zero-tolerance knife with the pocket clip removed that she carries deep in her pocket. She thinks, you bitch, sitting there with your nail polish, running your hands through your hair. She does not even know why Rilke does this. Why does she examine the ends of her hair? What is there to see? I hate everything about you, Turtle thinks. I hate the way you talk. I hate your little bitch voice. I can barely hear you, that high-pitched squeak. I hate you, and I hate that slick little clam lodged up between your legs. Turtle, watching Rilke, thinks, God damn. But she is really looking at her hair as if there is something for her to see about the ends. When the bell rings for lunch, Turtle walks down the hill to the field, her boots squelching. She wades out toward the soccer goal, hands in her pockets, and the rain sweeps across the flooded field in drifts. The field is enclosed by a forest black with rain, the trees withered and gnarled with their poor soil, thin as poles. A garter snake skates across the water, gloriously side to side, head up and forward, black with long green and copper runners, a thin yellow jaw, a black face, bright black eyes. It crosses the flooded ditch and is gone. She wants to go, to bolt, She wants to cover ground. To leave, to take to the woods, is to throw open the cylinder of her life and spin it and close it. She has promised, Martin, promised and promised and promised. He cannot risk losing her, but, Turtle thinks, he will not. She doesn't know everything about these woods, but she knows enough. She stands enclosed in the open field, looking out into the forest, and she thinks, the hell, the hell. The bell rings. Turtle turns and looks back to the school above her on the hill. Low buildings, covered walkways, throng of rain-coated middle schoolers, clogged downspouts sheeting water. 3. It is mid-April, almost 2 weeks since the meeting with Anna. Blackberries have clambered into the old apple trees and are knitted into a wildly blooming canopy. Quail mince in nervous coteries, topknots bobbing, while sparrows and finches go wheeling and banking among the trunks. She comes out of the orchard and through the staked raspberry field to Grandpa's trailer. Streaks of mold have run down the panels. The aluminum coping around the windows is caulked with moss. Pockets of leaf litter grow cypress shoots. She hears Rosie, Grandpa's old dachshund beagle mutt, heave herself up and come to the door, shaking herself and setting her collar to tinkling. Then the door is thrown open, and Grandpa stands in the doorway and says, "Hey there, sweet pea." She climbs up the steps and leans the AR-10 against the door jamb. It is her gun, a Lewis machine and tool rifle with a U.S. Optics 5-25x44 scope. She loves it, but it's too damn heavy. Rosie hops up and down, flopping her ears. "Who's a good dog?" Turtle asks Rosie. Rosie shakes herself excitedly, wagging her tail. Grandpa settles at the fold-out table, pours himself 2 fingers of Jack. Turtle sits down opposite him, takes her Sig Sauer from a concealment holster in her jeans, drops the magazine, and leaves the gun on the table, locked open, because Grandpa says that when a man plays cribbage with his granddaughter, the two of them should be unarmed. He says, "Have you come to play some cribbage with your grandpa?" "Yeah," she says. "You know why you like cribbage, sweet pea?"
"Why, Grandpa?"
"Because cribbage, sweet pea, is a game of low animal cunning." She looks up at him, smiling a little, because she does not at all know what he means. "Ah, sweet pea," he says. "I'm joking with you." "Oh," she says, and allows her smile to overtake her whole face, turning a little away from him, touching her thumb to her teeth shyly. It feels so good to have Grandpa teasing with her, even if she doesn't understand. He is looking at her Sig Sauer. He reaches across the table, sets a hand on it, lifts it up. The slide is locked back. The barrel is exposed. And he inspects it for fouling and touches it with a finger pad for grease, turning it this way and that way in the light. "Your daddy takes care of this gun for you?" he says. She shakes her head. "You take care of this gun for yourself?" he says.
"Yeah."
He swings the takedown lever and drops the slide catch. Carefully, he removes the slide from the frame, sits inspecting the rails.
"But you never fire this thing," he says.
Turtle picks up a deck of cards, shucks it out of the case, splits the deck, shuffles, and bridges them. The cards slither with satin-finish friction. She racks the deck sharply against the tabletop.
"You do fire it," he says.
"Why is it a game of low animal cunning?" she says, breaking the deck and examining the halves in either hand.
"Oh, I don't know," he says. That's just what they say.
Every night, she disassembles the gun and cleans it with a brass-bristled brush and with cotton patches. Grandpa sits looking into the clean, well-worn rails, and then he returns the slide to the frame. His fingers shake, holding the slide in place against the recoil spring. He seems to have forgotten how to engage the takedown lever. Sits looking at the catches and levers as if hesitating, as if for a moment he has lost his bearings on the gun. Turtle does not know what to do. She sits with the halves of the deck still in her hands. Then he finds the takedown lever and tries it twice before he manages to get the tight-fit steel tab to rotate. And then he pushes it into place, his hands shaking, and lets the slide relax forward. He sets the gun aside and looks at her. Turtle shuffles, bridges, slaps the deck down in front of him.
Well, he says, you're not your old man, that's for sure.
What? Turtle says, curious.
Oh, Grandpa says, never mind, never mind.
He extends a shaking hand and cuts the deck. Turtle picks it back up and deals them each 6 cards. Grandpa fans the cards before him and sighs, making slight adjustments with thumb and forefinger. Turtle discards her crib. Grandpa sighs again and encircles his whiskey in one big hand and sits, turning it slowly in the ring of its condensation, the soapstone sounding softly against the glass. He tosses back the drink, sucks air through his teeth, pours himself another. Turtle waits, silent. He tosses this back and pours himself a third. He sits rotating it slowly. Finally, he picks 2 cards and tosses them into the crib. Then he cuts the deck and Turtle draws off the start card, the Queen of Hearts, and lays it face up. He seems about to remark on how the start card has determined the fate of his hand, as if, on the verge of this observation, he is struck mute by the complexity of it.
The rails on that gun, he says after a minute, look pretty good.
Yeah, Turtle says.
Well, they look pretty good,
Grandpa says again, doubtfully. I keep them oiled, she says. Grandpa looks around the trailer, suddenly, wonderingly. His eyes run across the ceiling, across the ersatz wood paneling peeling away in places, over the dingy little kitchen. There is laundry on the floor in the hallway, and Grandpa frowns severely, looking at it all. It's your play, Turtle says. Grandpa teases one card from the others, throws it down.
10, he says.
Turtle throws down a 5, pegs 2 for 15. Grandpa, she says.
20, he says, pegging 2 for the pair.
30, Turtle says, throwing down a jack.
Go.
Turtle pegs 1 for the go, throws a queen. Grandpa lays down a 7 in seeming exhaustion. Turtle throws a 3 for 20. Grandpa throws a 6, says,
here, sweet pea,
and unbuckles his belt and draws off it the old Bowie knife. The belt leather is worn shiny black from the sheath, and he holds it out to her in his open hand, hefting it.
I don't use it anymore, he says.
Turtle says, put that down, Grandpa. We still need to score the hand.
Sweet pea,
Grandpa says, holding out the knife. Let's see what's in your hand, Turtle says. Grandpa puts the knife down on the table in front of her. The leather handle is old and black with grease, the steel pummeled dark gray. Turtle reaches across the table, collects Grandpa's hand, and pulls it forward to her. She gathers the 4 cards together and looks at them. The 5 of spades, the 6 of spades, 7 of spades, 10 of spades, and the start card, the Queen of Diamonds. Well, Turtle says, well.
Grandpa doesn't look at his cards. He just looks at her. Turtle's mouth moves with her counting. 15 for 2, 15 for 4, the run for 7, and the flush for 11 points. Did I miss anything? She pegs him 11 points. Grandpa says, "Pick that up, sweet pea." She says, "I don't understand, Grandpa." He says, "You're entitled to a thing or two of mine." She cracks one knuckle, then another. He says, "You'll take good care of it. It's a good one. You ever stick a son of a bitch with this, he'll sit up and take notice. This knife comes from me to you." She draws it from the sheath. The steel is smoky black with age, oxidized in the way of very old carbon steel. She turns the blade to face her, and it shows a single, unbroken, unglinting line without nicks or flaws, a shining, polished edge. She passes the blade gently up her arm, and golden hairs accumulate in a tied line. He says, "Go get the wet stones too, sweet pea." She goes to the kitchen and opens a drawer and pulls out the old leather bundle with the 3 whetstones and carries it back to the table. He says, "You take good care of that." She sits, looking at the blade, mute. She loves taking care of things. Rosie, sitting on the floor between them, perks up, her collar tinkling. She looks toward the door, and there is a loud knocking. Turtle flinches. "That'll be your father," Grandpa says. Martin swings the door open and steps inside. The floor complains beneath him. He stands spanning the hallway. "Oh, Christ, Dad," Martin says. "I wish you wouldn't drink in front of her." "She doesn't mind me taking a drink," Grandpa says. "Do you, sweet pea?" "Christ, Daniel," Martin says. "Of course she doesn't mind. She's 14. It's not her job to mind. It's mine. It's my job to mind, and I do. It should be your job, too, but you don't make it your job, I guess." "Well, I don't see the harm. I don't mind it," Martin says. "If you have a beer, I don't mind that. I don't mind it if you're going to pour yourself a finger or two of Jack. But I don't like it when you've had more than a few. That's not all right." "I'm fine," Grandpa says with a wave of his hand. "All right," Martin says thinly. "All right, come on back home, Kibble." Turtle picks up the pistol, drops the slide, slaps in the magazine, holsters it. Then she rises, holding the knife and the bundle of whetstones, and walks toward the door, where Martin puts an arm around her shoulder. She slings the AR-10 and turns to look back at Grandpa. Martin hesitates there in the doorway, holding Turtle. He says, "You all right, Dad?" Grandpa says, "I'm fine." Martin says, "I don't guess you'd want to come over for dinner." "Oh," he says, "I have a pizza in the freezer." "You're welcome to dinner. We'd like to have you over, Dad. Wouldn't we, Kibble?" Turtle is silent. She does not want to be in this. Does not want Grandpa to come over. Martin says, "Well, have it your way. If you change your mind, you just call, and I'll drive the truck up here and pick you up." "Oh, I'm all right," Grandpa says. "And Dad," Martin says, "take it easy. This girl deserves a grandfather, all right?" "All right," Grandpa says, frowning. Martin continues to hesitate in the doorway. Grandpa watches him, his head trembling a little bit. And Martin stands as if expecting Grandpa to say something. But Grandpa doesn't, and Martin tightens his grip on Turtle's shoulder, and they walk down together, following the old gravel road through the orchard. He is a big, silent presence beside her. They go through the evening woods, past where Grandpa parks his truck. Blackberry runners have knit over the median. Wild chamomile sprawls in the gravel.
Don't take this the wrong way, Kibble, Martin says. But your grandpa is a real son of a bitch.
Father and daughter climb the porch steps together and go in through the living room. Turtle vaults onto the counter and sets the knife down beside her. Martin strikes a match on his Levi's to light the burner, takes down a frying pan, and begins to prepare dinner. Turtle sits at the counter's edge. She unholsters the gun, racks the slide, and sinks four shots into a single mark. Martin looks up from cutting a squash and watches her empty the magazine. The slide locks back, smoking, and he returns his attention to the butcher block, smiling tiredly and lopsidedly, smiling so that she can see it.
Is that your grandfather's knife?
He dusts off his hands, holds one out. Turtle hesitates.
What?
He says. And she picks up the knife and hands it to him. He draws it from the sheath and walks around the counter to stand beside her, turning it to the light. He says,
When I was a kid, I can remember your grandfather sitting in his chair. He'd get in a mood and he'd drink bourbon and throw this knife at the door. Then he'd stand up and get it and sit down again. And he'd look at the door and then he'd throw the knife. It'd stick in the door and he'd walk over and get it. For hours he'd do that.
Turtle looks at Martin.
Watch this, he says.
No, she says. Wait.
It's fine, he says.
He walks to the hallway door beside the fireplace and closes it. He walks back and squares against the door. He says,
Watch this.
She says, It's not a throwing knife.
The hell it isn't, he says.
She grabs onto his shirt. Wait, she says.
Watch this, he says, seeming to gauge the distance.
He tosses the knife in the air and catches it by the spine. Turtle watches silently, putting her fingers in her mouth. Martin winds up and throws the knife, and it ricochets off the door and strikes the hearthstones. Turtle lurches after it, but Martin is faster, shoving her aside and picking it off the riverstone hearth and bending over it, putting his back between Turtle and the knife, saying,
Nah, it's fine.
Give it back, Turtle says. Martin turns away from her, bent over the knife, saying,
It's fine, Kibble, it's fine.
Give it back, Turtle says.
Just a moment, he says.
Turtle, hearing some dangerous note in his voice, steps back.
Just hold on, just one goddamn moment, he says,
holding the knife to the light while Turtle waits, her jaw flexing in annoyance.
Well, fuck, he says at last.
What?
It's this fucking carbon steel, Kibble. It's like glass.
Give it back to me, she says, and he hands it back. The blade is chipped.
It doesn't matter, Martin says.
Fuck, Turtle says.
That high carbon steel is worthless, Martin says. Like I told you, it's like glass. That's why they make knives out of stainless steel. That carbon steel, you just can't trust it. Hold an edge like a motherfucker, but it shatters and it rusts. I don't know how the man kept it like that. All through the war. Grease, I guess.
Fuck, Turtle says, flushed with anger.
Well, here, I'll make it good.
Forget it, Turtle says. It doesn't matter.
It does matter. You're mad about it, my love. I'll make it good.
No, I don't care, she says.
Kibble, he says. Give me the knife. I'm not going to have you pissed at me because that knife is as fragile as a fucking toy. I made a mistake, and I can set that knife up just like you want it, good as new.
Turtle says, It's something you have to care for.
Well, that's fucked, because,
Martin says, laughing at her anger.
I thought a knife was supposed to take care of you. I thought that was the point.
Turtle stands, looking down at the floorboards, feeling that she has flushed red to the roots of her hair.
Give me the knife, Kibble. A pass on the sharpener, and that mark won't even be there.
No, she says. It doesn't matter.
I can see on your face that it does matter, so give it to me and let me make it right.
Turtle gives him the knife, and Martin opens the door and goes down the hall past the bathroom, the foyer, and into the pantry, where there is a long wooden workbench along one wall with clamps and vices, and above that a wall of pegboard covered with mounted tools. The opposite walls are lined with gun safes, stainless steel cabinets of reloading materials, stacked 1,000-round boxes of 5.56 and 3.08. A spiral stairwell leads into a cellar, which is a room of damp, moldy earth filled with 5-gallon buckets of dehydrated food. They have enough food stored down there to keep 3 people alive for 3 years. Martin goes to a grinder bolted to the workbench and turns it on. No, wait, Turtle says over the roar of the grinder. Martin stands gauging the angle of the bevel by eye.
Fine, he says. It will be fine.
He passes the blade across the grindstone. It screams. He plunges it, hissing, into a coffee can of mineral oil, returns it to the wheel, holds it steady, his whole face intent, runs it across the grindstone, throwing a brilliant rooster tail of orange and white sparks, the edge feathering white, heat markings spreading across the steel. He lifts the blade away, plunges it again into oil, turns it over in his hand, and returns it to the grinder. He inspects it again and stands testing it against his thumb, nodding and smiling to himself. He turns off the grinder and the grindstone begins to coast, some hitch in the mechanism so that the sound of the slowing grindstone has a faint irregularity, a whoomp-whoomp, whoomp-whoomp. He passes her the knife. The mirror polish of the razor edge is gone, and the cutting edge scored and uneven. Turtle turns the knife to the light, and the blade throws 1,000 glinting sparks from chips and spurs in the edge. You've ruined it, she says.
Ruined it? He says, hurt. No, that's just because... No, Kibble. This is a hell of a lot better than whatever edge Grandpa put on there. That grindstone, it'll put a perfect edge on that blade. 100 microscopic serrations. That's what really gives the blade a cutting edge. The razor edge you had on that before, that's just the vanity of patient men. That's no good for the real activity of cutting, Kibble, which is to saw through things. A mirror polish like that, that's only good for a push cut. You know what that is, Kibble?
Turtle knows what a push cut is, but Martin can't resist.
He says, a push cut, Kibble, is the simplest kind of cut. When you lay the knife down on a steak and press without drawing the blade across it. But Kibble, you don't just push the knife into a steak. You draw the knife across it. That, what you had before, was a glorified straight razor. In life, you drag a blade across something. That's the business of cutting, Kibble. A rough edge. That mirror polish is meant to distract from the knife's purpose with its beauty. Do you see? Do you see? That razor edge. It is a beautiful thing. But a knife is not meant to be a beautiful thing. This knife is for slitting throats. And for that, you want the microscopic serrations you get from a rough grindstone. You'll see. With that cutting edge on there, that thing will open flesh like it was butter. Are you sad that I took your illusion away? That edge was a shadow on the wall, Kibble. You have to stop being distracted by the shadows.
Turtle tests the edge against her thumb, looking at her father.
That's a goddamn lesson in life right there, he says.
She turns the knife in her hands. Uncertain. He says, You just don't trust me, do you?
I trust you, she says, and she thinks, you were hard on me, but you were good for me too, and I need that hardness in you. I need you to be hard on me, because I am no good for myself, and you make me do what I want to do but cannot do for myself. But still, you are sometimes not careful. There is something in you, something less than careful, something almost, I don't know, I am not sure, but I know it's there.
Here, he says, taking the knife from her and shoving her down the hallway, leading her to the living room. They go back through the door and he points to a chair.
Step up on that, he says.
Turtle looks at him, steps onto the chair. Martin points to the table, and she steps up onto it, stands among the beer bottles and old plates and steak bones.
That rafter, he says.
She looks up at the rafter.
I want to show you something, he says.
What? She says.
Jump up to the rafter, Kibble.
What are you going to show me?
God damn it, he says.
I don't understand, she says.
God damn it, he says.
I know the knife is sharp, she says.
You don't seem to know that.
No, she says. I trust you, I do. The knife is sharp.
God fucking damn it, Kibble.
No, Daddy, it's just that it was Grandpa's knife, and he'll be disappointed.
It isn't his anymore, is it? Now grab onto that rafter.
I wanted to try taking care of that mirror polish, she says. Just try and take care of it, that's all.
It doesn't matter. That's steel. It's gonna rust away into pits by the end of the year.
No, she says. No, it won't.
You haven't had to take care of a thing like that yet. You'll see. Now jump up on the rafter.
Why?
God fucking damn it, Kibble. God fucking damn it.
She jumps and captures the rafter. Martin overturns the table from beneath her, spilling the deck of cards, the plates, candles, beer bottles. He puts his shoulder against it and shoves it out from beneath her, carrying all of its detritus along like a bulldozer, leaving Turtle hanging from the rafter above the floor. She racks and re-racks her fingers so they lie comfortably against the grain. Martin watches her from below with a grimace gathering almost to anger. He walks to her and stands between her feet, turning the knife this way and that.
Can I come down?
She says. He stands looking up at her, his face growing stiffer, his mouth setting. Turtle, looking down at him, can almost believe that looking at her like this makes him angry.
Don't say it like that, he says.
Then he raises the knife and lays the blade up between her legs, stands scowling up at her. He says,
just hang in there.
Turtle is silent and unamused, looking down at him. He presses up with the knife and says,
upsy-daisy.
Turtle does a pull-up, places her chin on the splintery beam and hangs while Martin stands below her, his face stripped of all warmth and kindness, seeming fixed in some reverie of hatred. The knife bites into the blue denim of her jeans, and Turtle feels the cold steel through her panties. She looks across to the next rafter, and the one after that, all the way to the far wall, each rafter felted with dust and showing wandering rat tracks. Her legs quiver. She begins to lower herself, but Martin says,
"Huh?"
Abruptly and warningly, the knife resting against her crotch. She trembles, not able to fully raise herself back to the rafter, and so puts her face against its splintery side, holding her cheek there. She strains, thinking, please, please, please. Then he lowers the blade, and she comes down with it,
unable to do otherwise, trembling and shaking with the effort of lowering herself as slowly as he lowers the knife. She hangs at the full extension of her arms and says, "Daddy?" He says,
"See, this is what I'm goddamn talking about."
Then he begins to raise the blade again, clucking his tongue warningly. She goes up into a full pull-up and hooks her chin on the rafter and hangs there, quivering. She starts to lower herself and Martin says, to stop her, grimacing as if it's sad the way things are. And he would even change it if he could, but can't. Turtle thinks to herself, "You bastard, you fucking bastard."
"That's two," he says.
He lowers the blade and she lowers herself with it. And then he raises it, saying,
"With a little incentive, you can really rack up those pull-ups, huh?"
He makes her lower herself with agonizing slowness. She does first 12 and then 13. She hangs trembling from her exhausted arms, and Martin, raising the blade with a slow and menacing pressure, says,
"You all done? Tapped out? Dig deep, Kibble. You better find something. Let's go for 15.
Her fingers ache. The grain cuts into her flesh. Her forearms feel numb. She doesn't know if she can do another.
"Come on," he says. "Two more."
"I can't," she says, almost crying with fear.
"You think the knife's sharp now, don't you?" he says. "You believe it now, don't you?"
He saws the blade forward, and she hears the denim whisper apart. She digs deep for any last ounce of strength, trying desperately to hold on. And Martin says,
"You might want to hold on, Kibble. You might not want to let go, little girl."
And then her fingertips peel off the rafter, and she comes down onto the blade. Martin jerks the knife out from under her at the last possible moment, and it saws through her thigh and buttock. She lands on her heels and stands there, splay-legged and astonished, looking down at her crotch, where there is no sign except a cut in the denim. Martin holds the Bowie knife bloodless and unmarked, his eyebrows going up in astonishment, his mouth opening into a grin. Turtle sits on her butt and Martin begins to laugh. She stoops forward to look through the parted cloth and says, "You cut me! You cut me!" Though she cannot feel or see any cut.
"You should have," Martin says and stops and bends double with laughter.
He waves the Bowie knife through the air to try to get her to stop so he can catch his breath.
"You should have," he gasps.
She lies back and unbuttons her jeans. Martin sets the Bowie knife on the counter and grabs the bottoms and upends her out of them. She spills across the floor, recovers herself, and then stoops over her thighs, trying to see the cut.
"You should have," he says. "You should have."
And his eyes clench with laughter. Turtle finds the cut and a whisker of blood. Martin says,
"You should have seen your face."
He screws his own face up in a mimicry of adolescent betrayal, opening his eyes wide in astonishment, and then, waving one hand through the air as if to brush all teasing aside, he says,
"You'll be okay, kiddo. You'll be fine. Just next time, don't let go."
At this, he begins to laugh again, shaking his head, his eyes slitting closed and leaking tears,
and he inquires of the room, "Jesus, am I right? Am I right? Jesus, don't let go. Isn't that right? Fuck."
He kneels down and takes her naked thigh in his hands and, seeming to see her distress for the first time, he says,
I don't know why you're so afraid, baby. You're hardly even nicked. See, I wasn't going to cut you. I took it out from under you, didn't I? And if you're so afraid, goddamn, next time, don't let go.
It's not that easy, she says from behind her hands.
It is. You just don't let go, he says.
Turtle lies flat on the floor. She wants to smash to pieces. He rises and walks down the hall and into the bathroom. He returns with a first aid kit and kneels between her legs. He tears open a green disposable wound sponge and begins to dab at the cut. He says,
This? You're worried about this?
There, I'll take care of it. There. He unscrews the cap on the Neosporin and begins to dab it into the wound. His every touch sends ripples of sensation through her body. He opens a Band-Aid and lays it flush against her skin and smooths it to ensure the contact is good.
All better, Kibble. Look at that. It's all right.
She raises her head, and ropes of muscle stand out from her mom's pubis to her sternum like a bread loaf. She watches him, and then she lays her head back down, and she closes her eyes, and she feels her soul to be a stalk of pigment growing in the dark foundation, slithering toward a keyhole of light between the floorboards, greedy and sun-starved. 4. It is Friday, and they have a Friday ritual. Turtle walks up from the bus stop to the 2 50-gallon drums where they burn their trash, flooded with rainwater the way any bucket, any barrel, or pot left in their yard fills with water, and will keep filling until June, though the weather has been unpredictable. She takes the fire poker laid crosswise over the barrel mouth and plunges it deep into the ashen water and draws out an ammo can on a looped steel runner. She pops it open and takes out a 9mm Sig Sauer and a spare magazine. She is supposed to take the precaution of clearing the house slowly and carefully, from the front door and into every room, discovering every target. The turtle has grown bored of the process, and so she goes up the porch steps and throws open the sliding glass door, gun up, and there are 3 training targets by the kitchen table. Plywood and sheet metal stands with printed silhouettes stapled to them, and Turtle takes them one at a time, sidestepping out of the doorway with tight double taps, one after another, 6 shots in a little less than a second. And in all 3 targets, the shots are between and slightly below the eyes, so close together that the holes touch. She walks casually to the hallway door, stands off to the side of it, on the hearthstones, and soft tosses it open and moves in a swift arc across the doorway. 3 steps back, and then sidestepping so that the hallway comes into view by degrees. And she takes each of 3 plywood and sheet metal targets as they appear around the jamb, tight double taps into the nasal cavity. Then she steps through the door and quickly out of the fatal funnel. Gunmen shuffle down the side of the hallway. Into the bathroom, clear. Into the foyer, 1 bad guy. 2 shots, clear. Into the pantry, clear. She ejects the magazine and replaces it with her spare and moves to Martin's bedroom door at the end of the hall. There is not enough room to pan across the threshold, so she tosses open the door and takes 3 swift, retreating steps back down the hallway, firing as she goes. 6 shots, 2 seconds, and when her field of fire is clear, she advances on the door again and finds 3 more targets, taking each in turn. Then there is silence, except for the hot brass rolling around the bedroom and the hallway. She walks back to the kitchen and sets the Sig Sauer on the counter. She can hear Martin coming up the drive. He parks outside and throws open the sliding glass doors and walks right through the living room and sits down heavily on the overstuffed couch. Turtle opens the fridge and takes out a red seal ale and pitches it underhand to him, and he catches it and fits the bottle cap between his molars and pops the bottle open. He begins to drink, taking long, satisfied gasps, and then he looks back to her and says, "So, Kibble, how was school?" And she walks around the counter, sits down on the arm of the couch, both of them looking at the ashy fireplace as if there were a fire there to absorb their attention. And she says, "School was school, Daddy." He rakes a thumbnail across his stubble. "Tired, Daddy?"
"Nah."
They sit and eat dinner together. Martin keeps looking at the table, furrowing his brow. They continue to eat in silence.
"How did you do clearing the house?"
"Well..."
"But not perfect," he says.
She shrugs. He sets his fork down and considers her, his forearms resting on the table. His left eye squints. His right eye is bright and open. The two compose an effect of complete and nuanced absorption. But when she looks at them carefully, it is upsetting and strange to her. And the more genuine her attention to his expression, the more alien it seems. As if his face were not a single face at all, and as if it were trying to stake out two contrary expressions on the world. He says,
"Did you check the upstairs?"
"Yes," she says.
"Kibble, did you check the upstairs?"
"No, Daddy."
"It's a game to you."
"No, it's not."
"You don't take it seriously. You come in here and you saunter around, placing your shots right into the ocular cavity. But you know, in a real firefight, you can't always count on hitting the cavity exactly. You might have to fire for the hip. Break a man's hip, Turtle, and he goes down and he does not get up. But you don't like that shot, and you don't practice it because you do not see the necessity. You think you're invincible. You think you won't ever miss. You go in there just cool and relaxed because you're overconfident. We need to put the fear on you. You need to learn how to shoot when you're shitting yourself in fear. You need to surrender yourself to death before you ever begin and accept your life as a state of grace. And then, and only then, will you be good enough. That is what the drill is for."
"I do all right when I'm afraid. You know how I do."
"You go to shit, girl."
"Even if my spread goes to shit, Daddy, it's still 2 inches at 20 yards.
"It's not your spread, and it's not how strong you are, and it's not how fast you are, because you have all those things, and you think that means something. That means nothing. It's something else, Kibble. It's your heart. When you are afraid, you clutch at your life like a scared little girl. And you can't do that. You will die, and you will die afraid with the shit running down your legs. You need to be so much more than that. Because the time will come, Kibble, when just being fast and accurate won't be enough. The time will come when your soul must be absolute with your conviction. And whatever your spread, and howsoever fast you are, you will only succeed if you fight like a fucking angel. Fall into fucking earth with a heart absolute and full of conviction, without hesitation, doubt, or fear, no part of yourself divided against the other. In the end, that's what life will ask of you. Not technical mastery, but ruthlessness, courage, and singularity of purpose. You watch. So it's fine that you saunter around. But that's not what the exercise is for, Kibble. It's not for your spread. It's not for your aim. It's for your soul. You are supposed to come to the door and believe that hell awaits just on the other side. Believe that this house is full of nightmares. Every personal demon you have, every worst fear. That's what you stalk through this house.
That's what waits for you down the hallway. Your worst fucking nightmare. Not a cardboard cutout. Practice conviction, Kibble. Strip yourself of hesitation and doubt. Train yourself to an absolute singularity of purpose. And if you ever have to step through a door into your own personal hell, you will have a shot at survival.
Turtle has stopped eating. She watches him.
Do you like your cassoulet?
He says. It's fine, she says.
You want something else?
I said it's fine.
Christ, he says.
She goes back to eating.
Look at you, he says. My daughter. My little girl.
He pushes aside his plate and sits there looking at her. After a while, he nods to her backpack. She walks to it, opens it, brings out her notebook. She sits down opposite him, notebook open. She says, Number one, Arrhenius. She stops, looks up at him. He puts one large, scarred hand across the open book, draws it across the table, looks down at it.
Well now, he says, look at that. Arrhenius.
What is that? She says. What does that mean, Arrhenius? He looks up from the book. His attention is fixed on her, and it is enormous with his affection and with something private.
Your grandfather, he says,
careful, wetting his lips with his tongue.
Your grandfather was a hard man, Kibble. He still is a hard man. And you know that your grandfather... Well, fuck. There is a lot your grandfather never said or did. There is something broken in that man, profoundly broken. And his brokenness is in everything he's done, his whole life. He never could see past it. And I want to say, well, Kibble, how much you mean to me. I love you. I do things wrong, I know I do. And I have failed you. And I will again. And the world I am raising you into, it is not the world I would want. It is not the world I would choose for my daughter. I do not know what the future holds, not for you and me. But I am afraid, I will say that much. Whatever you lacked, whatever I haven't been able to give you, you have always been loved. Deeply, Kibble, absolutely. And I wanted to say, you will do more than I have. You will be better and more than I am. Never forget that. Now here it is. Number one, Arrhenius.
Turtle wakes in the pre-dawn dark, thinking about that. Thinking about what he'd said. She cannot get back to sleep. She sits at the bay window and looks out at the ocean. The rose thorns itching at the panes. What had he meant? There is something broken in that man. Outside, it is clear. She thinks, you will be better and more than I am, reproducing his expression in her mind, trying to get at what he meant. She can see the stars out above the ocean, though when she looks north, she can see the lights of Mendocino reflected in the clouds. She turns, feet on the floor, elbows on her knees, and looks at her room. The beam and cinder block shelves, her clothes neatly stowed, her plywood platform bolted to the wall, with its sleeping bag and folded wool blankets. The door, the brass doorknob, the copper lock plate, the old-fashioned keyhole. She pulls on her jeans and she belts on Grandpa's knife and adds a concealment holster, telling herself, just in case, walking to her bed and reaching under it and pulling her Sig Sauer from the brackets there. She shrugs into a thick wool sweater and over that a flannel and walks barefoot through the hall, holstering the pistol. She climbs down the stairs, but stands on the lowest step, hesitating, soaking up the loneliness of the house in some way. as if it had something it could tell her. The generations of Alvestons who have lived here. And all of them, she thinks, unhappy. All of them bringing their children up hard, but all of them having something to them. Just down the hall, Martin is in his huge redwood bed, the moon casting the shadows of the alder leaves onto the drywall. And she imagines him there, solid, one hand resting on that enormous chest. She walks into the kitchen and eases open the back door. The night is clear. The moonlight is bright enough to see by. She walks along the joists and stands looking down into the black ferns. She can smell the creek. She can smell the pines. She can smell their curling, dusty needles. She switchbacks through myrtles and rusty fronds. She comes into the rocky creek and wades up it, her feet numb with cold. The trees rise blackly into the star-glittered vault. She thinks, I will go back now, back to my room. I have promised and promised and promised, and he cannot bear to lose me. To the east, the stream shines glassy from out the riotous dark. She stands breathing, taking in the silence for a very long time. Then she goes. 5. Turtle climbs out of Slaughterhouse Gulch and comes into a forest of bishop pine and huckleberries, deciphering them in the darkness by the wax of the leaves and the brittle mess of their sprawl, the dawn still hours away. At times, she breaks from the woods into moonlit open places filled with rhododendron, their flowers pink and ghostly in the dark, their leaves leathery and prehistoric. There is a part of Turtle that she keeps shut up and private, that she attends to with only a diffuse and uncritical attention. And when Martin advances on this part of herself, she plays him a game of tit-for-tat, retreating wordlessly and almost without regard to consequences. Her mind cannot be taken by force. She is a person like him, but she is not him, nor is she just a part of him. And there are silent, lonely moments when this part of her seems to open like some night-blooming flower, drinking in the cold of the air. And she loves this moment, and loving it, she is ashamed. Because she loves him too. And she should not thrill this way. Should not thrill to his absence. Should not need to be alone. But she takes this time by herself anyway. Hating herself and needing it. And it feels so good to follow these trackless ways through the huckleberries and the rhododendrons. She walks for miles, barefoot, eating watercress from ditches. Bishop pine and Douglas fir give way to stunted cypresses, to sedges, pygmy manzanita, to Bolander's pines stooped and ancient, hundreds of years old and only shoulder height on her. The ground is hard-packed and ash-colored, puzzled over with tufted, gray-green lichens, the land studded with barren clay ponds. In the dawn, the sun still banked among the hills. She climbs the fence and walks over the tarmac of a small airport, all shut up and quiet, the runway all her own. She's been walking for just over 3 hours, groveling through the underbrush. She should have taken shoes, but it doesn't much matter. She is so far accustomed to going barefoot that she could strop a razor on the soles of her feet. She climbs over the fence on the other side and walks out onto some other, larger road. She stands in the middle of it, on the double yellow line. A rabbit breaks from the underbrush, dim gray movement against the black. Turtle draws the pistol, racks it in one smooth movement, and fires. The rabbit pitches over in the salal. She crosses the road, stands with the kicking, delicate creature at her feet, and it is smaller than she thought. She picks it up by the back legs, a bare skim of soft fur over the coupled bones, articulated and sinuous.